Welcome to Ukraine Calling, where we try to increase the signal-to-noise ratio coming from the news and different views about Ukraine. I'm Marko Suprin for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here's a look at some of the stories that caught our attention this week. Let's remember what started 3 years ago this week. Students decided to protest against then-President Yanukovych's decision to abandon Ukraine's plans for joining the European Union. Many of them saw this as the decision that sealed their futures and signaled a return to a kind of Soviet feudalism or business as usual. Overnight, from November 29th to the 30th, the Ministry of the Interior sent in a special operations unit called the Berkut, or Golden Eagle, to break up the protest. A lot of the students were severely beaten, and some of them were arrested, while others wound up in hospital. Several of the students escaped to St. Michael's Monastery, where the church provided them with care and safety. Then, on November 30th, mass protests started on the square outside of St. Michael's Monastery. The protest grew from several hundred to several thousands that day, and on December 1st, over a million people took to the streets to protest the return to Soviet-style repression. 3 months later, it ended, with the death of over 100 students and adults from all walks of life, from all over Ukraine, who were killed by snipers from Ukraine's Ministry of the Interior, as well as what is now understood as having been directed by Russia's FSB. And Yanukovych fled to Russia. Those 3 months are now known as the Revolution of Dignity. The Maidan had all the markings of a national uprising that started on January 19, 2014, when the parliament voted in draconian dictatorship rules that was the spark for battles on Khrushchevsky Street. Before the last of the murdered were laid to rest, Russia invaded the Crimean Peninsula and tried to create a series of people's republics by arming locals and activating a network of FSB agents in southern Ukraine to break up the country and reconstitute the parts into the state of Novorossiya. The medals that were given to the Russian soldiers for their work in securing the occupation of Crimea have a date on them that marked the start of operations. That date is February 20th, 2014, the same day that over 100 people were shot down on the streets of Kyiv's Independence Square. With Russia's invasion serving as a background and the threat of losing their state, Ukrainians moved forward to elect a new president after Yanukovych fled to Russia. Several months later, Ukrainians returned to the polls to elect a new parliament. The economy was in turmoil. After all, Ukraine found itself the target of a hybrid war designed by Russia. Taking stock of the achievements of the Revolution of Dignity seems, well, it seems pointless, but it really isn't. Because when the war started, the government institutions, like the Ministry of Defense and the Ministry of the Interior, they were ill-equipped to respond to the invasion. A massive volunteer movement started to feed, clothe, and arm Ukrainians who volunteered to defend their country. That same volunteer movement created new organizations, non-governmental ones, to address the needs of over 1 million internally displaced people from Crimea, Donetsk, and Luhansk. The last years of the Yanukovych regime were nothing less than an attempt to turn Ukraine into something less than a Russian province. Billions were stolen by oligarchic schemes, and there was little evidence of a national interest in the central government. Civil society, however, naturally filled the void and took to representing and acting in the country's national interest, and they stopped the Russian invasion. Ukraine did create a national anti-corruption bureau that has been at the forefront of the fight against corruption in government. A new system of procurement was set up to make the tender process open and transparent, saving the country millions. A new national police was created to supplant the old Soviet militia, which was part of the Ministry of the Interior. More importantly, new training protocols were brought in with help from the U.S. Department of Justice, and Canada, Australia, and Japan have made deep commitments to reforming Ukraine's police force. Yuri Lutsenko, Ukraine's prosecutor general, has over 100 cases underway and has sentenced almost 40 people for crimes committed against the Euromaidan activists. Ukraine is very close to getting a visa-free regime with the European Union. The Ministry of Defense is going through a tough time, executing a war while at the same time reforming the system to bring them in line with NATO. New media outlets were launched like Hromadske Radio, Stop Fake, Euromaidan Press, the Ukrainian Media Network, and others in response to the Russian propaganda that was and continues to pollute Ukraine's information ecosystem. Still, the Kyiv Post reminded us a few weeks ago that, quote, law enforcement and justice system have proven to be impotent. No high-profile murders have been solved, and high-level corruption, which by some estimates took $40 billion out of Ukraine from 2010 to 2014, remains unpunished. But the International Criminal Court in The Hague will consider the Maidan crimes, with new evidence having been presented this week. The one big thing that the Revolution of Dignity did achieve is this. It was a national uprising that saved Ukraine from a repeat of history, when the people lost their state and were subsumed by Russian communist totalitarianism for decades. We'll talk more about where we are 3 years after the revolution with Ukraine expert Adrian Karadnitsky from New York, member of Ukraine's parliament Svetlana Zelyushchuk, and the CEO of Hromadske Radio, Andriy Kulikov, later in the show. Russian President Vladimir Putin claimed that there were indeed some individuals tackling some specific issues in the Donbas. However, Russia still denies its military invasion of Ukraine. The good news is that Russia's claims don't seem to be persuading the international community anymore. The voluntary community Inform Napalm released the results of their investigation this week. They managed to identify 75 Russian units which crossed the border to take part in the occupation and the war in the Donbas. The full report with the database of the incidents, Russian military units mapped on Ukraine's Donbas, and grouped by service and command will be available on our site. The intelligence service of Ukraine's Marine Corps claim Russian soldiers brought to Ukraine some previously unseen weapons, a type of flashbang shell that burrows into the ground and then shoots out like a firework, according to TV station TSN. The Russian occupation forces, coordinated by Russian professional soldiers, are using it near Mariupol, which remains the hottest point in terms of shelling. The Anti-Terrorist Operation Press Center reported that the week started with an 8-hour-long shelling of Ukrainian positions in the direction of Donetsk. Overall, the OSCE monitoring mission noted the escalation of conflict on the occupied territories of the Donbas this week and recorded numerous violations of the Minsk ceasefire agreement, with 460 explosions in the Donetsk region versus 118 explosions at the time of the previous OSCE report and 47 in the Luhansk region. The OSCE representatives reported seeing school children leaving their school to go to a bomb shelter in Marianka in the Donetsk Oblast because of the nearby explosions. Russian proxy forces continue to use the Grad weapon system that is supposed to be forbidden by the Minsk agreement in the Russian-occupied territories of Luhansk and Donetsk, namely near the town of Krasnohorovka. The ATO press center also reported that Russian occupation forces launched 48 attacks on the Ukrainian armed forces' positions in the Donbas over the past day. Two particularly heavy shelling incidents were reported next to Mariupol in the towns of Shastya and Avdiivka. It was in Avdiivka where the 8-hour-long shelling occurred this week. From the 18th of November, 3 Ukrainian soldiers died and 3 more were wounded. 4 more soldiers died as a result of a car accident near Mykolaiv this week. The reasons of the accident are still under investigation. Meanwhile, Ukraine is strengthening its military production. The first test launch of a new missile system was held last week, while new mortars were tested this week. Ukraine also signed a contract worth $600 million to modernize tanks from Pakistan, according to Ukraine's Ministry of Defense. The European Union finally seems to have awakened to the necessity to strengthen their military forces after Russia claimed that they are ready to shell NATO forces if necessary. According to The Guardian, member of the European Parliament Urmas Paet, a former foreign minister of Estonia, said that, quote, "Our union is not equipped to face overwhelming defense challenges. Europe continues to rely heavily on NATO capabilities and on U.S. solidarity." Remember that the Russian military has reportedly stationed Bastion anti-ship missiles in Kaliningrad, a piece of Russian territory between Poland and Lithuania, while member of the Russian Federation Council Viktor Ozerov said on Monday that Russia would deploy Iskander ballistic missiles and S-400 missile defense systems in Kaliningrad. The Trilateral Contact Group met on November 23rd to discuss the issue of hostages or people held against their will, according to Darko Olifer, press secretary of Ukraine's representative in the group, former President Leonid Kuchma. Ukrinform reported that according to the latest official data provided by the Security Service of Ukraine, the SBU, 109 Ukrainian citizens are held captive on the Russian-occupied territories of the Donbas. The whereabouts of only 57 Ukrainians is known. Meanwhile, over 500,000 people living in the Luhansk region are at risk of losing their water supply, becoming captives of the Russian Occupation Administration, the Luhansk People's Republic. The LNR has not paid for the water supply despite taking in money for the utility bills paid by the local population. Since the same enterprise supplies water to both Ukrainian-controlled territory and territory under Russian occupation, the bankruptcy of this enterprise is looming because of the LNR debt. And that will leave Ukrainians on both controlled and occupied territories of the Luhansk Oblast without water, according to the Union Press Agency. Ukraine's government abolished 367 regulations and restrictions in line with a new policy of deregulation this week. According to Deputy Minister of Economic Development and Trade, Maxim Nefyodov, most of these norms were seriously outdated given they were introduced in the Soviet era and have little to do with today, while others are junk laws, which force entrepreneurs to conduct monitoring according to Soviet standards, even though the standards were abolished a while ago, according to lb.ua. Prime Minister Volodymyr Groysman noted that canceling these regulations, Ukraine would be able to improve its performance in the World Bank ranking ease of doing business by several dozen points and attract more foreign investors. However, The government's primary concern is to ensure each Ukrainian businessman feel more freedom than before, according to the Cabinet of Ministers web portal. This development might be particularly timely, since Petro Poroshenko signed the law to ratify the Free Trade Zone Agreement with Canada this week, according to the president's press service. The agreement will allow producers to benefit from duty-free access to the Canadian market. Canada will abolish import duties for 98% of Ukrainian goods, which is crucial, because 30% of Ukrainian goods exported to Canada were subject to taxes. However, Ukraine will not get any upside to selling meat and dairy products, which traditionally play a crucial role in the Ukrainian export structure, according to Espresso.tv. The downside to the agreement is that Canada exports about 6 times as much more goods to Ukraine than the other way around, and Espresso.tv said that for the moment, Canada stands to benefit from the agreement more than Ukraine does. Nevertheless, according to Prime Minister Groysman, the Free Trade Zone Agreement opens up a $500 billion market for Ukrainian producers. The real impact of the agreement will be on Ukrainian businesses because they'll be motivated to invest in the development and modernization of their production in order to improve their competitiveness in new markets and by doing so, create new jobs in Ukraine. And following in Canada's footsteps, Israel also announced that it hopes to sign a Free Trade Zone Agreement with Ukraine in 2017. Another decision aimed at boosting development of Ukrainian financial markets was taken this week. The National Bank of Ukraine simplified the process of investment into external debt instruments with high individual credit ratings without obtaining individual licenses, according to the bank's press service. The first open auction selling stakes in bankrupt banks was held this week on the digital platform Prozoro.sales. The manager of Prozoro, Oleksiy Sobolyov, explained to Hromadsky.ua that currently, Ukrainian individual investors can receive only about the equivalent of $7,000 as compensation in case of a bank's bankruptcy, no matter what amount they had in their savings accounts in the bank. However, people might be able to get back the entire amount held on their accounts if the state manages to sell the bank's debt and shares and use that money to compensate account holders. This was the reason for holding the auction on Prozoro.sales. On this digital platform, the participants raise their bids openly so that people can watch the bids rise in real time, and this is supposed to minimize the risk of auction manipulation. Ukraine Calling listeners will remember that last year, when the public procurement system Prozoro was launched, it helped Ukraine save over 4 billion hryvnia, approximately $154 million, according to the site ipravda.com.ua. Adrian Karanitsky is the founder and managing partner of the Myrmidon Group that works with investors and corporations seeking entry into complex markets like Ukraine and Eastern Europe. For over a decade, he was the president and CEO of Freedom House, a pro-democracy and economic reform non-governmental organization in the United States based in New York. In the 1980s, he played a leading role in offering assistance to and building support for Poland's Solidarity Movement. He writes frequently for The Washington Post, Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, and others. He also co-founded the Ukrainian Jewish Encounter and is a senior scholar at the Atlantic Council. Svetlana Zaloshchuk is a member of parliament and journalist. She was elected to parliament in 2014 on President Poroshenko's party bloc. She's experienced in and out of government. In 2005, she was press secretary for Oleg Rybachuk, who was then deputy prime minister for European integration. And after the collapse of the Orange Coalition, she continued her efforts and co-founded an initiative called Chesno that acts as a watchdog on members of parliament. She was, up until recently, the representative from Ukraine to the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. And finally, our third guest, Andriy Kulikov, is the CEO of Hromadske Radio. He was senior producer for the BBC's Ukrainian service in London. He has worked on TV and radio for over 20 years. He's the author of several books and has translated other works from Russian into Ukrainian and from Ukrainian into English. He also teaches journalism at the Kyiv Journalism Institute and the Mariupol State University. We actually all owe a big thank you to his grandmother, who was his inspiration for going into radio. Svetlana, Adrian, Andriy, thank you for being on the show today. Andriy, I'd like to start with you. You were out on the Maidan as it started. A lot of the Hromadske Radio people were out there because the Hromadske Radio started in the summer of that year. And we collected a series of interviews when the Maidan started. On the third anniversary, a few days ago, there was a group of more radically minded people who ended up smashing the facade of Sberbank, a Russian-owned bank. Do you think Ukrainian society is more radicalized 3 years after the Euromaidan, or is this a small group of people that act out to portray a certain picture for friends of ours to the north that then gets translated into other news agencies in order to promote the idea that Ukraine is a failed state.
Frankly speaking, I would say that the Ukrainian society has become less radicalized if we compare the state of things today with what was there 3 years ago, because people like those who you mentioned were in Maidan as well, and they were quite numerous, and they threw Molotov cocktails on law enforcers, and they engaged in clashes with law enforcers, and they did smash some windows at those time. Why we pay more attention to them now? Because they act against the background of a great many people who are silent and who are passive, in contrast to what was there in Maidan.
When you say silent, you mean the there was a concept in U.S. politics about the silent majority. Is that what you're referring to?
Probably, but I would not like to refer to American concepts here. We have enough of ours.
Very true. What were some of the main accomplishments, do you think, of the Euromaidan? And what are some of the challenges that stand in the way of Ukraine's aspirations for European integration? One of the things that recently came out was that Yuri Lutsenko said that Ukraine's general prosecutor said that 35 people have been sentenced and 152 people are currently being prosecuted for crimes committed against activists during the Euromaidan.
One of the problems with these figures is that none of the more senior officials were sentenced. And if you ask an average Ukrainian to name those people who have got their just deserts, then probably they will be at a loss. The former president is still at large in Russia. Many of his ministers and closest allies are free. Some of them walk the streets of Kyiv and other Ukrainian cities. So, yes, maybe they punished a colonel or a captain and some sergeants or privates, and maybe they punished some judges who ruled against the law during those times. But until they show that they are really after the big bad guys, I think most of the people will remain disappointed.
Svetlana, you're inside parliament almost every day. Is that possible?
You mean the progress?
Correct.
Well, when you're asking about the accomplishments, I have two parts in my mind. First of all, it's justice that you had referred to. And second, it's a progress with reforming of the country. And I agree here that there is a silent majority. And mostly, I think people are silent because there is a lot of disappointments and disillusionment with because of the high expectations that was there and because of a high public demand for the reforms, for real changes. But at the same time, we have to say that during the last 2 years, nevertheless, a lot of things have been done, probably more than in previous 23 years, when it comes, for example, for adopting all the new legislation and building the institutions. Probably it's one of the most crucial things what we started is to establish the institutions like Anti-Corruption Bureau and Agency on Preventing of the Corruption and Electronic Declarations and Public Broadcasting System and so on. And regardless of the names, regardless of the parties, these institutions will bring us further on the path of the reforms.
Do you think that the group of Euro-optimists that ended up entering parliament in 2014, are they fighting a losing battle against creating these institutions and then manning them at the same time?
Euro-optimists, they still have a status of troublemakers rather than decision makers in the parliament. And also, if we talk about the new generation in the government and on the local level as well, what I'm trying to say that we have been invitees in the old forces who took us on board to the parliament. And now at the moment, we are in the process and we managed to block number of the initiatives or push further number of the initiatives and came to some better results. At the same time, when time comes and elections will knock the door, we'll find ourselves in the same shoes that we are still have no institutions that can have a chance to offer the society an alternative, a new proposal.
Adrian, that's an interesting segue because you've been involved in a lot of work in Eastern Europe, beginning in the 80s with the Solidarity Movement. What are some of the things that Hromadske Suspilstvo, civil society, can actually do to ensure some of these irreversible changes?
Well, let's talk about how different this is, because even from the outset, when President Poroshenko was elected, yes, he was a part of the Maidan, but he came with a very different profile than the typical activist who was on the Maidan. He was a billionaire who was hired by the Ukrainians to manage the country. I don't think they came with expectations of a revolution. They came with expectations of some kind of gradual but quick shift in their economic conditions and someone who could establish order at a time where security was looking out of control. Now, he's had a very mixed record in managing all of these kinds of things, some accomplishments and some not. However, I don't think that there was a revolutionary expectation. And I would say that the society, and if you look at who was on the Maidan, yes, hundreds of thousands of people, and around the country, hundreds of thousands more, but that's still only a very small proportion of the society. I think the expectations about European integration were, one, expectations of stopping corruption and stopping Yanukovych in a basic sense, and secondly, getting the economy to rise. And I think that that's the main motivator of the public. And so anti-corruption has support because it's seen by the public as a deterrent or as a drag on economic growth and on their well-being. So I think that there is this sort of, you know, it's an attitude that these people are stealing and we have less. But I think that the economy is a much more complicated organism and corruption is only one part of it. Rule of law is another part. And so it's a very, very, you know, but I think that the main interest of the public is economic well-being. And maybe for a while they were diverted by the slogans of European integration, but I don't think that was the main motivator. I think they were diverted also because of the security threat and the mobilization and the consolidation of the nation around the ATO and so on. But when things, came to a sort of a low-intensity conflict and a long-term conflict waged by Russia against Ukraine, the economic priorities moved to the fore as they have for the last 25 years. If you look at, there is not a single successful political leader who did not see within a year or two their ratings go all the way down down the hill. Maybe Mr. Kuchma maneuvered a little bit, but he had a very special circumstance where in his second election he had very favorable opportunities because the candidates who were arrayed against him were very weak, and the strongest candidate died in a questionable accident. But I think that historically the Ukrainian voters or an Ukrainian electorate is economically driven rather than politically driven.
Last week on the show, we mentioned a new document developed by the Atlantic Council with a foreword by probably a colleague of yours now, Radoslav Sikorski, former foreign minister of Poland. And in it, the authors have said that the Kremlin has opaque connections with businesses and political parties, and these connections, quote-unquote, facilitate corruption and quid pro quo relationships, and their aim is to move policies in Europe away from integrations and toward Russia using, quote-unquote, corruption and coercion. Svetlana, I'm going to start with you. You represented Ukraine at the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, like we said earlier. Do you agree with this assessment? And if so, what do you think can be done to change the way things work in the EU?
Unfortunately, I have to agree with this analysis. And working in the Parliamentary Assembly of Council of Europe, you see of how efficient sometimes Russian money is in Europe. And in different delegations, you can see that there are parliamentarians that are motivated in that or another way, as well as very efficient work of PR agencies or some consulting firms or some, you know, some spin doctors that are working in Europe in different kind of institutions. Also, we know it as a fact from the investigations about the money invested in European politics as well, right? A support of Le Pen, for example, and those loans that have been promised to Greek Prime Minister and so on. And it's interesting that it's only 3 weeks ago, from what I remember, the European Parliament started to discuss the role of Russian propaganda in Europe and counteractions of EU against it. It's only 2-3 years after this aggression and after very efficient role of Russian propaganda in the whole Western, I would say, civilization. So it's what I'm trying to say, that it's too late. But when it comes to the counteractions and what can be done, first of all, it's unity. Second of all, it's proactive policies, not only in the information sphere, but in security sphere, information sphere, in the counteraction of Russian efforts, in politics itself, on some measures that can prevent Russia efficiently to invest in those parties and NGOs and media and so on and so forth.
Andriy, do you see Russian Trojan horses in Ukrainian politics, especially in the civil society sector?
I don't know. It would be very easy, and sometimes it is very easy for people to put a stamp on other people to say, listen, they are working for another state, they are enemies, let's oust them or punish them or whatever. I would, however, like to hark back to what Adrian has said about Ukrainians being mostly economically driven to protest. In many cases, yes, I agree. But the so-called revolution of dignity, and here the so-called relates to revolution, not to dignity, it was about dignity and about the desire to have a vote, to have a say in deciding the fate of the country. So that, for me, was the
essence. Well, I fully agree with you. The point that I was making is that the people who took part in the revolution were motivated by values. The people, the broader masses, are always primarily motivated by the economy. It was a subset, a specific subset, initially the middle classes of Kyiv, who were upset at the violence against young people who idealistically came out to defend certain values. And I think that, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people who rose every week were, you know, there was a middle class revolution, not based on their economic interests. It was the wealthier people in Kyiv and patriotically motivated people, but not economically motivated people. And certainly the people on the Maidan who took the bullets were not motivated by money. But what I'm saying is that the broader population gauges its attitudes. There's a moment of euphoria and they buy the values of the people who went out on the Maidan and the Orange Revolution and so on. But I think it's still an active minority that has those kinds of values and has been pushing the country. The rest of the country has, I would say, traditionally been passive, has been a spectator of this, and is more driven by the economy. But I fully agree with you that there was a mass movement, and it was a political movement, not an economic movement.
And I fully agree with your protracted explanation, okay, because it does put across the T's and dots the I's.
And interestingly, I would make the passivity argument, which is that the economically motivated people have never mobilized. In the history of Ukraine, despite all of the hardships, there has never been a serious mass movement. There has not been a left movement, a trade union movement, anything like that, that you see in countries like Greece or Spain or others where economics is driving. It's always been driven by politics, but again, it's still a minority.
The only thing that I would like to add to this discussion is, again, about people who are working for Russia or supposedly working for Russia. I think that in analyzing the outcome of the Revolution of Dignity, we do not take into account a thesis that the overthrow of Yanukovych might well have been orchestrated by Russia, because it was in Russia's interest to get away, to throw away the pro-Russian president and use this as a pretext to defend, quote-unquote, to defend the Russian-speaking population and to invade Crimea and the Donbas area. If they were doing this while Mr. Yanukovych was still in power, no person in the world was going to believe them. Mr. Yanukovych was replaced by people who may be called nationalists, this argument started to be a factor.
I'm not sure whether I agree with Andriy's thesis about that this was a directed plan, but it was an opportunity. So when they saw the opportunity, both to take territory and to create or to try to create a failed state, which would give them even more opportunity, it was primarily used as a mobilizing device for Putin's continued hold on power. And I think that all of Putin's external maneuvers and his violence is driven by an imperialist imperative, but it's an imperialist imperative that's designed to maintain these high ratings and to build up this sort of frenzy for great power that he has built up within the Russian people and which, unfortunately, a large portion of the Russian people warms to.
I think Andriy makes a valid point that the revolution of dignity wasn't necessarily about economics. There was a value aspect to it. And when Ukrainians see these kinds of moves by the oligarchs, it changes the dynamic. Is that something that the parliament is capable of dealing with?
Parliament has done a couple of initiatives that aimed to contract the influence of oligarchs on the politics. But you also have to be honest with ourselves that parliament is not really a platform where the decisions are made. Unfortunately, it didn't become the main platform for the decision-making process, right? It's still in certain cabinets where people with oligarchs together decide on where Ukraine should go and which decisions should be made. But I'll have to mention, we adopted this new legislation on state financing of the parties with establishing an alternative for new forces to get some finances from the state, and so they don't have to go to the oligarchs to beg for money. And additionally, Agency on Prevention of the Corruption have to check now, to scrutinize every single party in this country on how they spend and get their money. But it's interesting that if I may, to give you one illustration, during the last year, in the first two quarters of this year, actually, Democratic Alliance found to be the most rich party in the country. This small party with a very low support of, which is combined of activists, Blok Petra Poroshenko and Narodny Front is getting much less and spending much less the Democratic Alliance in according to the official reports. What I'm trying to say that the law is very good. The implementation is not
quite
working.
Can I just make one point? I think the big problem, the big gorilla in the room, is the television resource, and I think that is a huge problem for people who care about press freedom. On the other hand, it's the problem of how do you reduce oligarchic political influence. It's the principal instrument, and it's also the principal instrument in this back and forth between government and the media. So we have a very complicated situation, and lovely though Hromadske Radio is, and lovely though a bunch of fringe media initiatives are, it is only a very small portion, regrettably, of the spectrum.
You mentioned fringe media, Adrian.
I don't want to call it fringe media. I would say not the largest, the most powerful media. The most. They're not fringe because their values are real media values. So I don't want to call them fringe.
Well, we live in what I would think is a David and Goliath media age. Oligarchs own 80 to 90% of the media information ecosystem in Ukraine. You know this very well, Svetlana. You were a journalist. Andriy, you're still a journalist. Adrian, you also were a journalist. Both of everyone here has been around long enough to see the changes in how the news is consumed. Are we, Hromadske Radio, the small David media outlets, are we losing to the oligarchic Goliaths? We just launched a crowdfunding effort recently. Do we stand the chance at winning this information war?
Well, I'm absolutely sure, because there are so-called asymmetric ways of dealing with your enemies, if we regard them as enemies, even more so with your competitors.
So you're saying Hromadske Radio is a slingshot, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, definitely. And if we talk about oligarchs owning 80 to 90% of the media, well, my answer is they own wrong media.
That's a good one. Svetlana, what do you think?
I think the most important thing is that actually journalists themselves organize within the media outlets to fight for their rights, for the profession, and for their rights, for the freedom of speech. This is what has happened in 2004. I remember when I was working on the Fifth Channel, we wrote a public agreement with our owner, Poroshenko, that he does not have right to interfere into news policies. And if there was attempt even, we had the right, we had a chance to, you know, to stand for what we believe was right. So it's, you know, we adopt many, many rules in the parliament while trying to sort of push it forward. For example, media ownership transparency bill, right? But it won't help until journalists themselves will start respect them, respect their profession, respect their right for the word, and start to find it, to fight for it from within. Then those rules and practices and within movements will meet and will give a different quality of journalism.
And they have to start to respect their audiences.
Brilliant. One last question for everyone. There's been a lot of chatter on social media and other outlets that 2017 will decide the fate of this new international order. Elections in France, Germany, there's some referendums coming out in several other European countries. EU is pushing for a fast Brexit, not a slow Brexit. NATO is lining up to protect its eastern flank. Rasmussen, the former General Secretary of NATO, said that the entire liberal democratic system is under pressure. His newsletter came out today, and he says that we need a liberal awakening. How would you define that? Let's start with Adrian.
Well, I think that the problem is deeper. That is to say, that liberalism in the 19th century, in 1848, was identified with the nation. And I think liberalism abandoned nations and abandoned identity for larger projects, and it lost some contact with parts of populations. And as populations became more vulnerable, they turned back inward, but the liberals were on the outside. So I think that, in a sense, liberals are also to blame for this, because they were too disconnected from national identity. Ukraine has an opportunity. Ukraine is in the middle of a war and a conflict, which has consolidated values around the civic nation, but it is a civic nation which has an identity, which has a cultural contours and a certain pride. So I think there's an opportunity in Ukraine to start the push back, to link liberalism again with a form of patriotism or nationalism, which, and I saw it a little bit, you know, Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Convention became much more patriotic when they saw which way Trump was going, but their natural predisposition was not to go into that direction, to talk about problems, to avoid this kind of appeal. There was a sort of an uncomfortable relationship between liberalism and nationalism and patriotism. And now I think there's an opportunity both in Ukraine and in the United States and in other countries for liberal voices to understand that sentiment and to understand that just globalized forces and international standards and so on, it's not enough. People have to feel a sense of belonging. They have to feel a sense of a more intimate community.
Andriu?
Marco, when you enumerated the coming elections, I say that you should have probably mentioned the possible early elections in Ukraine. And as much as I would like to see Ms. Alishuk back in the ranks of public activists or journalists, I, in this case, say run for the parliament and take other people like you to the parliament. Then people like me, who do not want to run for the parliament, will support you, and together we will have a chance.
Oh, I appreciate it a lot, and I agree with you a lot. This is the probably main challenge for the whole generation, whether they are up to the challenge, to the mission in front of them. And this mission is actually to propose to the society that they have a future, and we don't have to rely on old forces, and we have to build institutions in the moment. However, I have to say, when you ask about this, your question, right? I think that integration processes that started after the World War II can be described with a pendulum movement. And it looks like this pendulum is started moving back. And we as Ukraine, which embrace this integration processes, unfortunately, we find ourselves in very unfavorable external conditions, US, Brexit, elections in Moldova, Bulgaria, situation in Hungary, Austria, and so on and so forth, Greece, you name it. So I think that the challenges in front of Ukraine are those open questions for the whole Western democratic world of how do we deal with that. And Ukraine is not able to answer that question alone. It's up to us, these progressive democratic forces in the whole Europe, to answer to this question.
Well, if ever there was an opportunity to use the phrase that the gauntlet has been thrown, I think this is it. I hope that we're all ready to pick it up. Adrian, Andriu, Svetlana, thank you for joining us today. On November 26th, Ukrainians will be commemorating the memory of millions of Ukrainians, many of them children, that died from an artificial famine that was engineered to bring about the genocide of Ukrainians. Ukrainians call it the Holodomor. Officially, it is called the Day of Remembrance for the victims of communist totalitarianism and genocide against the Ukrainian people during the Holodomor of 1932-33, 1921-22, and from 1946-47. Stalin's Soviet regime engineered an artificial famine to retain control over Ukraine, because without Ukraine, there would be no Soviet Union. Ukrainians across the country will light a candle in memory of those who were murdered. Consider lighting a candle on Saturday night, wherever you are, in memory of those who died in the genocide. At the same time, remember that the Holodomor did not break the Ukrainian nation. Ukrainians survived. Ukrainian historian and director of Ukraine's Institute of National Memory, Volodymyr Vyatrovich, published an op-ed on the Radio Liberty website where he wrote, quote, "The Holodomor did not break them, the survivors, and it did not force them to betray their individual and national self. The Holodomor was deliberately organized by Stalin in order to suppress any possible libertarian movement in Ukraine by killing millions of people and demoralizing the survivors." Vyatrovich asserts that the Holodomor was a tool for converting the Ukrainian nation into an impersonal Soviet nation. However, some people managed to preserve the memory of these events and communicate them through art. As if to support these ideas, Canadian director Ian Ignatovich is about to release a new Canadian film about the Holodomor called Bitter Harvest, scheduled to be released in the beginning of 2017. The film is a love story set in the background of an uprising against collectivization. This week, a new film called Alive by director Taras Chimich premieres in theaters around Ukraine. The film is a historical drama about 1950s Ukraine set in the Carpathian Mountains and tells the story of a young woman named Anna Popovich who was being chased by the then Soviet government's Ministry of State Security and ends up in a camp of the Ukrainian insurgent army. The film is based on real live events, and the real Anna Popovich even consulted on the film. Although World War II officially ended in 1945, the Ukrainian insurgent army continued fighting the Soviet occupation up until the mid-1950s. Chimich even filmed the interrogation scenes in the prison on Lonskoha Street in Lviv, which is now a national museum dedicated to the victims of occupation regimes, and the museum's director, Ruslan Zabili, also consulted on the film. This prison is a unique symbol for Ukraine. It was used by three occupation governments, Polish, Russian-Soviet, German, and then back to Russian-Soviet. A lot of people, including Ukrainians, Jews, and anyone who opposed the occupation, were interrogated there before they were sent on to Auschwitz during World War II. The film was financed in part by the Lviv State Administration, and we'll include a link to the film on our site. Our song this week is from the soundtrack to the movie Alive, called I Feel You. The song is by Bria Blessing, originally from Sugar Land, Texas, but moved to Ukraine with her parents when she was only 13. Trust me, I know what you're asking, and the answer is yes. I will try and get her on the show as soon as possible. Enjoy. Завжди ти є зі мною.